I'm actually recording this, so all the people who didn't come here, I'm actually going to load the talk on my website later today. So if you didn't come here, you'll be able to get it. And I've got a few other ACT resources from trainings I've done and some that I've stolen from other ACT people. The other thing that I found quite daunting about this is, 75 minutes and it's a talk. Do you know how many words there are in 75 minutes of talking? I actually did a search for this, so I'd go, okay, what's my word target? And I think it's something like 10 to 12,000. And I thought, my God, I'm writing half a thesis. And but I'll let you know another thing apart from keep calm that I found in my travels was there's this fantastic lecture given by I think a chemical engineer. I've forgotten his name. It's called The Last Lecture. If you actually... Yeah, I haven't watched it all the way through, but yeah, if you want to see a man living his values and valuing his life, get a hold of this, The Last Lecture. It's been turned into a book and...
Yeah, it's a book. I've read the book.
You've read the book?
Yeah, I bought it from New York somewhere. I tried to give it to my son, and he sort of looked at me disdainfully. No, I'm sick of your books.
Yeah.
But it's a great... It's absolutely wonderful.
So you another one of these parents who does ACT processes on their children?
Yes. No, I did my long term these days because they're
both long. Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's not like Tuesday is one of that's a similar thing as well, isn't it? Tuesday is a Tuesday.
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
No, I've heard of it. Yeah. I want to see it. It's an old film, isn't it?
It was turned into a film. It was a book, I think, originally. Right. And again, about a man who's dying and he imparts his wisdom and experience to a younger man.
Yeah.
So anyway, here's what we're here for. Oh, and the other thing is, I'm a counsellor. I get paid for listening to people, not for talking. So I'm really not practiced at this. I am actually going to refer to my notes because when you think it's 10,000 words, I have to talk very quickly. And I thought I wrote some really good stuff, so I think I better actually share some of that. I'm a magpie. I pinch stuff from all over the place. There's this fabulous person in the ACT community. She has a foot in the DBT community as well, Kelly Kerner, who I found this on. A blog, I think. It's an attribution to somebody she got. This is what we're trying to do. We start at this level in our ability with anything. And whether you become a dropout, an expert, or an amateur depends on, well, I'll tell you later on what it depends on, but you kind of can end up, I suck at this, I give up. Do you notice many therapists doing this? It's interesting, isn't it? Many therapists do. Or you get where most of us end up, I think. Amateur. That's actually not a bad thing, being an amateur. I'll show you why a bit later. Now that I can do it, I'll just keep doing it the same way. So I'm saying people in the ACT community are not like this, but there are therapists who are. Or an expert. I'll keep pushing myself. There's always some way to do it better. Another bit of sort of setting context for this. In the invitation to present, they said, you know, how much is this didactic, how much is it experiential? And I went, why do I have to even say that? It's like, if you stop having an experience here, tell me. Right? So anybody at any stage stops experiencing, that's really important. And we'll rush an ACT therapist to re-engage with experiencing. So, yeah, I mean, mostly I'm going to be talking and you'll be looking at slides and you'll be experiencing out there, but towards the end, I'm actually going to ask you to do something. And there's a funny kind of thing, because a lot of this talk is not ACT stuff, it's actually from elsewhere. By the way, has anybody here been to Scott Miller's Super Shrink workshop? Yeah. Okay. So, for you, a lot of this might be redundant. You might have seen it all before. For a lot of you, it'll be sort of challenging intellectually, not as in hard to understand. It's a new look at things. But in the end, the experience I'm getting get you to do is actually going to be quite hard. So if you want to run away, it's fine. You're free to do that. Now, this is something I say to clients when I start with them. It's like, my approach isn't necessarily going to fit you, so it's fine to actually say, I can't stand this anymore, I'm leaving. Just let me know that's why you're leaving. Because some people leave and get better, and I don't know that, and I'd like to know. You know, did that have an impact? Same thing at the end of the talk. I'm really glad we've got Jenna, I'm really glad we've got Jenna and Patty here, so I can get feedback from people who are kind of living and breathing ACT a lot and tell me sort of how useful this is. But that invitation's for anybody. Okay. So just also so I know who I'm talking to, who's not from Melbourne? Hands up if you're not from Melbourne. Okay. I hesitate
because I wasn't born here, but I live here.
Yeah, what do you mean by what?
Yeah.
Unsure of yourself. So, you know, you could be doing lots of other things on this beautiful day. Thank you for coming. Who's really new to ACT? This is like, great. Okay, so I'm very appreciative that you've come here and that you're already thinking about how you can develop mastery. So we got some people who've done a lot of ACT, you know, been doing it for years, maybe even done thesis with you. So hands up if you can claim you've done years of ACT, you know, 2 years or more. Okay, just a few. Okay. All right. So who's kind of early in their relationship with ACT? Like, okay. So you might be at what I'd call the third date stage. You know, you're kind of evaluating ACT. It's like you've had a relationship with CBT, but you know, all that disputation got to you. Client-centered, you know, after a while it was just Okay. And ACT is kind of interesting and maybe a bit sexy, and shares the same values as you. So what I'm going to do now is look at my notes. Okay. But who here has this feeling sometimes of being out of their depth, you know, when you're working with a client? Just about everybody. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what that feeling is and how it actually has a purpose, that it actually serves a purpose. And I call this first section discomfort of the gap, because it's like there's a gap between what you're experiencing right now, what you're doing right now, and how you see yourself as you should be as a therapist. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it, because if you've had that experience, you know it. So I'm going to show you this. These are the four steps. You're kind of confronted by this gap. You want to get across it to get somewhere else. Well, why? So in the next section we'll look at, like, what's your purpose in facing that kind of challenge. And in the section after that we'll say, and I'll describe how you actually get to cross the gap or develop mastery. The question is about how one becomes excellent. And in the last section, I'll talk about how you do that from an ACT perspective and how you do it with ACT, so both with ACT skills and from an ACT frame. So, who remembers their first counselling session, first time they sat down with a real live counselling? Yeah. Was a priest. But you know, you sort of sit there with this other human being and your mind's going crazy about, you know, I've got to remember to lean forward and keep eye contact. Oh yeah, what was that about? Minimal encouragements, okay, use minimal encouragements. Oh, no close questions. Oh, and stay present. Be authentic. Okay. What if they ask how experienced I am? What if they ask, I'm supposed to help this person? No. So the gap is this kind of experience. And it's pretty uncomfortable. And there's a, you can see how there's an element of experiential avoidance there. It's like, well, we want to get through that first counselling experience or those kinds of uncomfortable counselling experiences until we're good enough at it that it doesn't happen anymore. Okay. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen anymore, like ever, but much less often. Okay, so when you sit down with a new client, are you now still as nervous as you were that first time? Probably not. So some aspects of it become automatic. It's actually what we're talking about at the end of his talk there. I think you were quoting Kirk, was it? Joe, about the adaptive unconscious. Yeah. All right. So the other aspect of that is, though, your values are quite closely connected to that experience, because why does it matter? It matters to you that you can actually help this person, you know, that you have a responsibility for helping this person. So you're kind of faced by, here's where my aspiration is, here's where my capability is. It's a bit like our friend there jumping the chasm. That's how it seems, anyway. Okay. But I was interested in doing this presentation because I found as I was supervising people who came to me for ACT-specific supervision, more so than anything else I'd experienced, that they were saying, look, I feel this way when I'm, you know, like I do diffusion, but I kind of not really comfortable with it, or, I think I did a creative hopelessness intervention, but I'm not sure if I stuck with it long enough. It's not just a lack of technical skill, it's like a real discomfort with the ACT space. It actually feels like an uncomfortable place. And other therapy approaches that I've worked in, you got that at the start. You know, the first time I did hypnosis with someone, I was like, what's going to happen? Are you going to go into a trance? How are you going to do all the same kind of stuff as the first counselling session? But the discomfort level dropped to a manageable, acceptable level much sooner, much faster.
Do you have any ideas about why that is, Julian? Do people tell you what it is that makes them...
Yeah, and it's a funny question because there was somebody talking on the list of about 6 months ago or so that reported that one study found that people doing ACT training compared to people doing similar CBT training felt less of that with ACT than with CBT. And I thought, no, that's not my experience or my supervisee's experience. Some of that here in Australia may be because, you know, apart from Wollongong, we don't have programs where people actually get taught that and can do a thesis and get fully immersed in a community. I think that's a big part of it, and that's what we're going to come to at the end of the presentation. Yes, this seems to be there, and I found with myself that two or three years after I'd started doing ACT, I still have it to this day, and I kind of feel like as part of the reason that I was talking with Jason Maloma last night about establishing fine supervision with him, because I think, I've just got to expose my work to someone with that level of authority to find out, do I actually know what I'm doing? Here I am supervising these other people, but how good am I? How consistent am I? So, and the really weird thing about this, I'm not trying to boast here or anything, but when Russ and I ran the peer supervision group here in Melbourne, after one meeting, he said, you'd probably be one of the top three ACT practitioners in Melbourne. How do you know? Really? okay. Well, I'll have to stop this. Sorry, I'll just have to do something to make sure that doesn't happen again. So, it's like there's this struggle to not only master ACT skills, but master our own discomfort with trying to practice them. Now, I also found on the ACT list, so somebody posted an article and I sort of refound this article. generosity, about the importance of stupidity in scientific research. Okay? So this gap that occurs not only for us therapists, I mean, there's also been talk about imposter syndrome, but I want to read you a little bit of this because I think it helps you understand what science is about, but also, you know, what we're going through and some of the motivation for why you want to stay with this uncomfortable feeling. So I recently saw an old friend of mine for the first time in many years. We'd been PhD students at the same time, both studying science, although in different areas. She later dropped out of graduate school, went to Harvard Law, and is now a senior lawyer for a major environmental organization. At some point, the conversation turned to why she'd left grad school. To my utter astonishment, she said it was because it made her feel stupid. And after a couple of years of feeling stupid every day, she was ready to do something else. I thought of her as one of the brightest people I knew. What she said bothered me. I kept thinking about it. Sometime the next day, it hit me. Science makes me feel stupid too. It's just that I've gotten used to it. Now, this guy's a professor of cell biology, I think it is. So used to it, in fact, that I actively seek out new opportunities to feel stupid. I wouldn't know what to do without that feeling. I even think it's supposed to be this way. For almost all of us, one of the reasons we liked science in high school and college is that we were good at it. That can't be the only reason. A bit of psychology here, which is nice to see. But high school and college science means taking courses and doing well in courses, getting the right answers on tests. So go back to something Paul said in his talk about wisdom earlier, quoting the RFT book. It's like there's a lot of reinforcement for human beings getting right and being consistent, coherent. If you know those answers, you do well and get to feel smart. PhD in which you have to do a research project is a whole different thing. For me, it was a daunting task. I like this story he's got. Yeah. My PhD project was somewhat interdisciplinary, and for a while, whenever I ran into a problem, I pestered the faculty in my department, who were experts in the various disciplines that I needed. I remember one day when Henry Torg, who later won a Nobel Prize, told me he didn't know how to solve the problem I was having in his area. I was a third-year graduate student, and I figured that Torg knew about 1,000 times more than I did, conservative estimate. If he didn't have the answer, nobody did. That's when it hit me. Nobody did. That's why it was a research problem. And being my research problem, it was up to me to solve. Once I faced that fact, I solved the problem in a couple of days. I sent him to the story. Not too much creative hopelessness there, but... He goes on to say, it wasn't really very hard, I just had to try a few things. You can kind of hear the sort of stuckness because, oh, just go ask the expert. Oh, the expert doesn't know. And you could sit there going, oh, that's it. But, you know, this man, I assume, has that scientific value of curiosity. So he's pursuing. Okay, so... And in fact, I like his last statement of this section, not the last statement of the article. If our ignorance is infinite, the only possible course of action is to muddle through as best we can. Mm-hmm. Try that with life. Oops, wait a minute. Did I miss a bit? Yes, I think I missed a bit.
Julie and I ran an early career academics program at ANU, and after you requested that article, I've sent it out to them, and they're just really getting a lot out of it. Just
yeah.
The perception, you know, because it's particularly an issue for early career academics. I think.
Mm. I mean, look, sorry to have a little private chat here, but this really speaks to this issue of wisdom. I think to this, like, okay, we actually know nothing.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry, right slide. So, where do you find the gap? Here's a model of knowledge acquisition that you might be familiar with. Okay, everybody starts in unconscious incompetence, or what the hell is that? You know, like when I came across an article in 2003 that referred to ACT, I went, oh, what the hell is that? I know nothing about it, and I have no idea. I had no idea that I was so ignorant about it. I kind of knew what acceptance was and thought I knew what commitment was, but So then you find out how little you know by doing a bit of practice. Hopefully you close the gap by becoming consciously competent until you get to the stage of mastery or wisdom and your competence is unconscious. Now, in other words, it's like driving a car. Okay? So you start off, it's really uncomfortable. First time I drove a car, I let the clutch out because I had no idea what it did. So my dad looked at me like, what are you doing to the car? So that was unconscious incompetence. But you get to the stage where, okay, you've got to think about what you're doing to master it. And then later on, you've got to think about what you're doing and you know you're doing it. And then later on, you don't even think about it. So you have a conversation on the phone, which you shouldn't be doing, but, or, you know, talk to someone in the car and, you know, you stop at traffic lights and give way and user indicators and all that sort of thing without thought, without conscious involvement. But where mastery is developed is actually between those two, and we actually don't even necessarily want to get to the conscious competence stage. Now, I'm going to hope this works. I want to show you a little bit of football, American football in this case. I'm going to show you some Australian football. I'm glad we've got Americans and Australians. Everybody's happy. Any New Zealanders? Sorry, no rugby. Okay. Now, this is advertisement that's being shown in the States that, you know, just advertised the National Football League. I've just taken a segment of it. But if you write down everything that comes along there, you can find this on YouTube. And the sound's not really good on this. I'll turn it up. But he's kicking towards that. There's a bell up in that tower. And when you listen, he actually hits the bell three times. Just the idea of an NFL fantasy team picking me at 12 movies. So the question we're kind of faced with is, how does somebody get that good? And can he teach that to the St Kilda forward line so we can win the grand final against Geelong next year? That broke my heart. Okay. But before, you know, show that slide from the Keep Calm, people are a little bit late, but from his book about that, quote from Nietzsche, if a person has a why, he can understand any how. So let's start with the why develop mastery? Like, why would you want to spend a lot of time in that gap, that really uncomfortable place? So, here's your chance. Do you want to do this as partners or do it calling out? Because this is a lecture, and I'm hoping after 2.5 days of being here, you're kind of a bit aware of values and can maybe just yell out, like, why do you do therapy? Why is this important to you? And why do you want to get better at it? Like, why did you come here today? So, from anybody.
Develop a skill, something that you value. A skill that you value.
So you're talking about you. See, I'm asking you to talk about you.
I would want to do it to develop a skill that I value, whether it's this or some other skill.
Okay. I can't help myself. Why do you want to develop a skill? Like, why is that important?
Well, if it's something that I can use in a broader context, if it's something that when I'm working with clients that is going to be a benefit to them, it makes my work easier.
Somebody else?
I'm curious.
There's no right answer, by the way. These are your values. So.
Curiosity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Curious about people, about myself.
Yeah. So it's a little bit like what Schwartz was saying in the science article. It's like, you know, it's uncomfortable not knowing. You want to know it.
And is the question, why develop mastery about act or mastery of anything?
Mastery of act in this case. Because what I'm going to do at the end is show you how to develop mastery in act, even though I haven't done it yet.
So for me, developing mastery, I've only discovered act this year, and I was receiving act as a therapy technique. And as an organisational psychologist, I could see this is an amazing technique that I could see applications of it in my field.
Yes.
So having seen it on the receiving end, it's like, okay,
yeah,
how can I learn this to use it for others?
And most of you can't see her face, but I can see someone connected with a value.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So who else? And again, no right or wrong, it's just what you, yeah.
Well, I in the same way, discovered ACT this year, and I'm really inspired by it. So I suppose it's following my passion, i.e. my values, to try and develop more mastery in it.
Yeah.
I work as a GP. I'm very disillusioned by the drugs that my patients are taking, and I'm seeing it as a non-drug alternative to what I'm doing. So I guess wanting to improve my job satisfaction, improve the degrees of which I'm actually helping.
That, sorry, what's your name?
Sally.
That sounds, when you're talking about the concern about the drugs, like you want to free people from...
Yeah. Well, I'm increasingly disillusioned in the role of, well, in my setting, chronic pain patients on strong painkillers and patients with psychiatric problems on psychotropics. And I'm starting to see, you know, I only just heard the term experiential avoidance 3 or 4 months ago, but I'm starting to see what I'm giving people is actually assisting them in their process of experiential avoidance.
Yeah.
And I feel extremely uncomfortable with that.
Uh-huh.
But I've got to have an alternative.
Yeah.
I've got to give them something else.
Yeah. So you can kind of hear there's a sort of fire to end that suffering, and the urge to end that suffering. So it actually, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think this is really worthwhile. In whatever way you can, just for a minute, close your eyes and connect with the value that you care about brought you here. And if you weren't thinking of a value when you decide to come here, think of one now, like to continue to be here. So one of the things we do know, going right back to the Smith, Glass and Miller meta-analysis, is that psychotherapy actually works. A lot of people, a surprising number of people, don't know how well it works. May not be able to read the small print on it, but this is a comparison of any psychotherapy for adolescent depression compared to cyclosporine for kidney transplants. Minimizes chance of rejection. Cholinesterase inhibitors for Alzheimer's disease. And here we have aspirin for preventing heart attacks. That last one has a negligible effect. The reason it's become so widely disseminated is that the cardiologists who were doing the research saw the slight effect and said, we're going to do this. You know, I'm not going to not have this on my side if I can. So I'm not a really strong stats person, but the effect size is basically, if you've got a 0.3, well, 0.2, 0.3, that's a weak effect size. 0.8 is considered strong, 0.5, about average. But this is compared to standard treatment. For adolescent depression. So generally, most psychotherapies get an effect size of about 0.8. In other words, about 80% of an untreated sample, 80% of people will be better off than an untreated sample. And, you know, after as few as 8 sessions. So, the thing is, though, with the studies that yield these effect sizes is you get quite a wide variability in outcomes. And it seems to depend on who actually does the treating. I've got some bad news for you here. So who here would identify themselves as a professional therapist? You know, would actually use the word professional to describe this? Okay. That's the bad news. In 1979, Durlach reviewed 42 studies comparing professional and non-professional counselors. Sometimes they're called paraprofessional. And, you know, we want to see, well, who's better? Of the 42 studies, professionals proved to be more effective than non-professionals in only one study. But the non-professionals were found to be more effective in 12 studies. And now I know what you might be thinking, okay, with methodological flaws, so you don't get pulled that out, or standardize the clients, maybe. Check with the severe clients, I bet the therapist will do better. Okay, well, of course, this upset a lot of academic psychologists, one of them including my thesis supervisor, Chris Sharpley. So he and John Hattie and Jane Rogers reanalyzed the studies Durlach surveyed, excluded the methodologically weaker ones, and it included a few newer ones. And what their analysis showed was that the methodologically stronger studies were more likely to confirm Durlach's findings. So, either way, the client wins, but clients who seek help from paraprofessionals are more likely to achieve resolution of their problems than those who consult professionals.
Can I just ask, please, could you clarify the definitions of professional and paraprofessional?
Yeah, what they looked at, I can't categorically, I've got to kind of in brackets say that a lot of this research I've sort of done myself, fitting in around, you know, practice and family, so I'm not a professional was someone with something like a master's degree or a doctorate in psychology, psychiatry, social work, something like that. Like an actual, you know, someone who's been to university and studied the stuff.
So a doctor's getting to that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I appreciate you might sort of question, Sally, some doctors have minimal training.
Yeah, well, that's true. But I mean, I was asking in general, but I suppose I was thinking where doctors fit into that, because some... some would
yes.
really not be professional therapists
yes.
and others would.
Yeah.
But they're put into that group, aren't they?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know because I haven't read the original articles. I've kind of
so
gone through.
So who are the non-professionals? Non-professionals
would be volunteers, people like AA counsellors
yeah.
or self-help group facilitators, people like that.
Okay.
So, you know, what do you do in science when... you get a finding and then it's replicated. Right? You just go on and answer another question, but not psychologists. We just found out we're ineffective. So now we're going to take another look at the data, which is what Berman, I think it is, did. Yeah. 1 year later, Berman and Norton conducted their own, we'll get to that, meta-analysis of the same studies that Hattie, Sharpley and Rogers looked at. And use more appropriate statistical procedures. I've got some notes in there on what they did differently, but I can't remember exactly what it was, but a better procedure was used. And reduced the number of studies to 32, just the best of the best. Guess what they found? No difference. Okay, well, at least the paraprofessionals didn't have an advantage now. All right. So, like I said, you can think of lots of objections to this. So, Bright, Baker and Niemeyer took a look at professional and paraprofessional group treatment of severe depression. I know it says depression there, but they took people with BDI scores of 20 to 23. I don't use the BDI much, but I think that's my high name. Okay, and what they looked at was questions of... they compared a CBT group people were trained in, and mutual self-help, which is actually a formalized self-help group format, but it's used predominantly by paraprofessionals in peer-led groups. And when they looked at type of therapy, whether the person was professional or not, or adherence to the protocol, that's what they found. No difference between CBT and mutual support. No difference between whether it was a professional or not doing it. But the more they adhered to the outcome, to the manual, the better the outcome. So this is the first clue. So, but it's kind of bad news for therapists, right? Because if it's about sticking to the manual, paraprofessionals do as well, you know, less training. What are we going to university for? What are we doing there? You know, rather than getting an education, and that's a worthwhile thing for other values, but in terms of an outcome for clients. So, similarly in the NIM depression study, I think this is called the TDRCP. Big study, I think 10,000 or 12,000 clients, multiple centres, and they had three or four arms, so there was CBT, IPT, medication, and placebo. Okay. And lots of researchers have analysed this data for various purposes. So one group led by Blatt, Stanislaw, Zuroff, and Pulkonis found that when they stratified the therapists into groups according to their outcome, they couldn't differentiate the least effective group from the most effective group by their years of experience. So having done more therapy, having been around doing it longer, doesn't make you better. That's why I start to think, okay, if I'm the person in Melbourne who's been doing ACT therapy a long time, that doesn't mean I'm good at it. Don't tell my supervisor.